This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Space tourist Denis Tito reportedly paid $20 million to the Russians to get to the International Space Station. Jim Newman got there the old-fashioned way, as a mission specialist on the space shuttle Endeavour. In 1998, he and his team members helped assemble parts of the space station and ready it for scientists yet to come. Jim Newman is a physicist who was accepted into the astronaut program about a decade ago. He's set to return to space this January, when he'll work on repairing and improving the Hubble Space Telescope. We invited him to join us to talk about what's involved in performing construction in space and how work on the International Space Station is progressing. When I spoke with Newman earlier this week, I asked him what still needs to be done.
In order to make the space station a real space station, it needs an airlock. And that is what is expected to go up in June, about the middle of June, I think, now. The final piece that will make it a true space station. The airlock will be delivered and installed. And once that is there, then when the shuttle is not visiting the space station crew members will nonetheless be able to go outside in their spacesuits, do a spacewalk for doing repairs or further assembly as required. Right now, the space shuttle has to be there, and the astronauts and cosmonauts use the shuttle's airlock in order to go outside and do the spacewalks that are required for the assembly of the space station. That's the last major piece that gives us that capability. There are a number of other pieces coming up. Right now we have one laboratory module, the United States laboratory module, Destiny. There's also going to be a European Space Agency laboratory module, a Japanese Space Agency laboratory module. Those will be coming along as well. So we'll need more solar arrays for power. We'll need a habitation module at some point so that we can house more crew members at a time. And we should also be getting a cupola, which is a way for the astronauts to look outside while they're doing some of the robotic operations and see it firsthand.
This is with the big arm that can move things
exactly
around, fix things, that is affixed to the space station?
Yes. On the last assembly flight, which just returned a week or so ago, the Canadian-built robotic manipulator system was delivered to the space station and deployed successfully. That arm will be used for installing some of the, if not most, of the major components that are still coming up. And all of that hardware is now, just about all that hardware is now at the Kennedy Space Center being processed for delivery to the space station.
Could you tell us what the space station looks like? What shape it is? How big it is?
Right now, the solar arrays are the predominant feature. And in fact, the solar arrays reflect enough of the sun back towards the Earth that you can see the space station as a bright star in the early morning or late evening as it happens to go by wherever it is that you live. And there's a site on the Internet where you can go to spaceflight.nasa.gov. And you can actually find a good picture of the space station and when it will be going by overhead so that you can actually see, as a bright star, your space station going by overhead. So if you can imagine in your mind about four or five styrofoam cups and connect them together one after the other and then in a line, in a straight line right now, and then to put on a set of solar arrays on top of the middle one. And that is roughly what it looks like right now, just a number of modules connected together. Eventually we'll add a few more styrofoam cups out in front, which will be the European and the Japanese laboratory modules. Hopefully we'll add another module, which will be a habitation module, and then perhaps a few more over the years.
I'd like to talk about what you had to deal with putting this thing together. When you were part of the Space Shuttle Endeavour crew in 1998, part of your assignment was on a spacewalk to do some mechanical repairs and installations on the outside of the space station. Could you talk about how you adapted these construction techniques for the environment of space? How did you just hold yourself onto the thing without floating away?
Well, Barbara, the spacewalk is actually an amazing experience, and Jerry Ross and I trained for that flight for a couple of years, and we trained for it in a large swimming pool where they put us in a spacesuit, put weights on our legs so that we're neutrally buoyant, we don't float up or sink down, and then we can actually take advantage of the zero gravity to, when we are in space, to actually maneuver ourselves around very easily and to move large objects if needed. And what Jerry and I did was, working in these spacesuits, we did go outside and hooked up a number of power cables. Essentially, if you can imagine making a laboratory or an office building in space, you still have to have your power, your data cables. Eventually, you're going to have fluid lines. And Jerry and I hooked up computers, again, on the outside, cables, an early communication system. And by taking advantage of the unique environment of space and planning for what the capabilities of a person are, you pre-integrate a certain amount of the job, which means do it on the ground, and then the rest of it you say, okay, we'll have them connect these cables here, we'll have them install this this large structure there, and then you can go practice it in the pool and make it all come together and work.
How did you crawl around on the surface of the ship? Are there handrails that you hold on to?
Exactly. What we did is we used a number of existing handrails, and we installed a whole bunch of others in order to make it easy to crawl around. So a spacewalk is really a misnomer. Since there's nothing to walk on, we really space crawl around the space station. And in order, from a safety point of view, we have a safety tether, which connects us to the space shuttle or to the space station so that you can't float away. And if there were to be even a problem with that, we actually also have what's called a little jet pack. We call it SAFER, and Simplified Aid for EVA Rescue. A little jet pack that has some nitrogen thrusters, which we can use to guide ourselves back to the space station should we become separated.
Because otherwise you would just be stuck there in space. There's nothing to push against to move forward.
Exactly. And that's why we make sure we always are tethered safely to structure of some sort or another, because it would be very embarrassing to float away from the space station.
You can say that again. So say you go to tighten a bolt or loosen a bolt in space. What keeps you from just your body turning around the bolt rather than the bolt itself turning?
Well, Barbara, you've just identified the major problem of working in zero gravity, and that is that you have to be well restrained in order to, as we call it, react the torques and forces. On the Earth, gravity holds us so firmly to the ground that it's pretty easy to react, to put in the force needed to turn those bolts. But every once in a while, you know, if you have a really hard bolt, you'll still reach your hand out, even on the Earth, and grab a hold of something in order to really pull against it. Well, we have to do that all the time in space. We unloosened a whole lot of bolts and tightened up a number of others. And on subsequent flights, they've been installing fluid lines with high connections and doing all sorts of things like that. So the key to working in space, either inside the space shuttle or space station or outside, is to set up your work site in such a way that you can work efficiently. Anything from typing on a computer, when you type on the computer, your fingers push against the keys, and that will push you away from the computer. So you have to restrain yourself one way or another to do something even as simple as type on a computer. And when you're outside, you have to either have your feet in a foot restraint so that both feet are captive, and then you can use both hands on the task. Or if you're a free floater, then you have to grab a hold with one hand onto a handrail and then put the electric drill, essentially, with the other hand and then react it all through your hands.
One of the more unusual aspects of working in space is that on the space station, you're spinning around the Earth, I think it's at more than 17,000 miles per hour. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're
about 17,500 miles an hour.
Which takes you in and out of sunlight every 45 minutes. Does that affect your construction work?
Well, it actually doesn't affect the construction work too much because we have really good helmet lights so that we can, when a period of darkness is coming up, when the sun's on the other side of the earth, then we simply turn on the helmet lights and we can continue on. When we get to the sun side of the earth, then, of course, we can turn the lights off. But it's so bright that we'll often put down our sunglasses in the spacesuit, which is a gold visor, and in order to cut out some of the sun, because then there's way too much light. The other effect of the day-night cycle, every 45 minutes day, 45 minutes of night, is that things on the sun side get very hot. If you can imagine in the middle of winter outside on a cold night, and you're standing in front of a very hot fire, one side of you is going to get very hot, and the other side of you is going to be very, very cold. And that's the way it works in space. The side of you that is facing the sun can get quite hot, well over 100 degrees, and the side that is away from the sun can get quite cold, well over minus 100. So the suit has to be able to handle that, and we have special heaters in the gloves, for example, to keep our fingers from becoming frostbitten.
My guest is astronaut Jim Newman. He was a crew member on the first assembly flight to work on the International Space Station. His next mission is to repair and work on the Hubble Space Telescope. It's scheduled for January. Let's take a break now, Jim, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. I'm back with astronaut Jim Newman. He's been on the crew of three NASA space flights. He worked on the construction of the International Space Station, and he's due to leave in January on a mission to perform further repairs to the Hubble Space Telescope. American businessman Dennis Tito recently returned from his short vacation on the International Space Station. He reportedly paid anywhere between $12 and $20 million to the Russian government for the jaunt. NASA was dead set against this originally. Could you go over for us NASA's objections to tourists in space?
I think that philosophically NASA has no objections to tourists in space. In fact, NASA is very much encouraging of commercialization of space. It's simply a question of timing. I think Mr. Tito's contract with the Russians was originally intended to be executed on the Mir space station, which was a Russian asset and therefore was wholly within the realm of the sort of contract they should and could make on their own. However, the space station is in the midst of its initial assembly and construction. And typically, we see when tourists are admitted to a construction site that occasionally there's problems. And certainly special precautions have to be taken. So I think that from the point of view of the well-being of the crew, the well-being for Mr. Tito, and the preservation of these billions of dollars of assets, that NASA appropriately voiced its concerns about the timing of the mission. In the end, I personally believe in space tourism and hope that we make space flight sufficiently safe and sufficiently inexpensive that anybody who saves up some money, perhaps the equivalent of a round-the-world cruise or two, can go into space. It's a truly marvelous experience, and I don't know of anybody who doesn't support that concept. I think in this case it was an unfortunate conflict between the Russians' desire to fulfill their contract and the operational needs of a construction site in space. If NASA had not voiced concerns and something had happened, there would have been, I think, a public outcry to the opposite effect. And that is, why would we allow an American citizen to take this risk? We do believe in the commercialization of space very strongly. It's simply a matter, I think, of timing and making sure that the stage is set so that it can be done responsibly
I'm talking with astronaut Jim Newman. Did you grow up wanting to be an astronaut? Were you one of those little kids enthralled with the lunar landing?
Absolutely, Barbara. I was 13 years old when the people first went to the moon, and I looked at that and said, man, that looks like a really, really exciting thing to be doing. And it was something I've always, since that time, I've always wanted to be involved in.
Well, you studied physics. You went to Rice University. Did you go there because it's in Houston?
That was part of the reason. And after graduating from Dartmouth College, I realized that it was time to take seriously this goal. And so I decided to come down to Houston, which, of course, is where all the astronauts live and work here at the Johnson Space Center. And so I went to Rice University for my PhD in physics. And I learned basically that the most important thing to do in grad school is to learn a lot and do a good job. So I kept my nose to the grindstone so that I could eventually get an interview. And I was fortunate enough to get an interview. In fact, I was fortunate enough to get four. It took me 6 years. And
what happened in the first three?
Well, I was awfully young, actually, for my first interview. I was only 27. And those of us on the other side of 27 realize how young it really is. And so I was just glad to be interviewed at that stage. And then I came down to the Johnson Space Center to work and to gain experience. Worked here as an instructor, actually, training astronauts and flight controllers. And so I got to know the system here, and they got to know me. And I interviewed a couple more times unsuccessfully as I was improving my skills and learning the things that has stood me in good stead later. But finally, I was successful in 1990 and was admitted into the astronaut program.
Do they tell you when they turn you down why you didn't make it?
Not exactly, because it's really hard to say. There are so many qualified applicants for so few spots that it comes down to, at some level, the personality of the selection committee in that particular year. And it just took me that many tries to, I guess, perhaps to grow up enough or to find the right selection committee. And it turns out with, for example, there's 2,000 to 5,000 applicants for on the order of maybe 15 to 20 spots. And a significant number of the successful applicants, about two-thirds, come from the military, about one-third from the civilian. And so the competition is so keen that that there just aren't enough spots for all the qualified people.
What's the longest you've lived in space?
I've been in space a total of a little over a month, 32 days, and the longest flight was 12 days. So I've had 10, 11, and 12-day flights.
What are you working on right now, today, in order to prepare for your mission in January?
As soon as I leave here, Barbara, I'm going to be heading over to a briefing where we're going to talk about Hubble Space Telescope contingency spacewalks. We've been practicing the normal things we expect to be doing, replacing the solar arrays, putting in this fantastic new camera. Come next year, when we finish with the refurbishment of the Hubble, the pictures that you see should be 10 times as good as they are now, and they're already spectacular. So we practice the normal things quite a bit, but we also practice the contingency. What happens? What are we going to do if we can't deploy the telescope again, if one of the latches is stuck? Well, we'll go outside and we'll unscrew this bolt, and then that will cause it to be released, the latch to release, and then we'll be able to deploy the telescope. Or what will we do if this breaks? And we spend a lot of our time, in addition to just training the normal things, is we train what happens if. It's sort of like defensive driving to the max. In defensive driving, they teach you, what are you going to do if a tire blows right now? So you're always thinking about that. What are you going to do if that guy swerves in front of you? What are you going to do if? And that's what we do in the space program all the time. We're always thinking, what are we going to do if? And so that's what we'll be working on today.
Jim Newman, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today.
It was my pleasure, Barbara. Good day.
Astronaut Jim Newman. This is Fresh Air.